Then God said, let us make man in our Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food, and to all the beasts of the earth, all the birds of the air, and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was everything, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thank you, Jesus.
Well, thank you very much for having me here with you today. I've never been to St. Susie Baptist, even though I spent, you know, the first 28 years of my life just over the bridge there. Drove through St. Susie a lot, but never came to this church, so I'm really lucky to be here with you. And to find out some of the connections. Jim Honor, who is the principal of your school here, right? He and I were in the same youth group.
Oh, yeah.
At Caribou Baptist for many years, so yes, marvellous, the little connections are there. Cheryl, I've known for a long time. We were co-chaplains on a girls' brigade, front of Mariah, where I was the token male. It was actually quite a profound experience because, you know, I related to this topic, being a white male. I had never known any experience of being in the minority and not having power before. And it was really interesting, that experience. Helped me understand things a little bit better. I grew up in a home that was remarkably non-violent. My father drilled into all of us children that probably the most unforgivable thing a man could do would be to hit a woman. And, you know, I can't think of anything that would create greater shame in my family than that. And I went through life, I never got into a fight at school. I lived a life that I hadn't experienced much violence. And then when I was youth pastor at Caringbah Baptist, not that I experienced violence being youth pastor at Caringbah Baptist, but I was walking down the road one day to the shops in Caringbah, and I saw this gang of young people, like probably about 15 or 16 of them. They looked at their age 15 to 18, 19. And there was this kid in the middle of this group. They're all pushing him in and, you know, slapping him around. And I just thought, oh, it's just a bunch of friends playing silly, you know, being, you know, having a crack at one of their mates. And so I walked by, but then I heard a nurse who was walking along the other side of the road call out, you leave him alone. Leave him alone, you kids. And I turned around and saw they just laughed at her. I said, hang on, this kid might be in trouble. So I walked back, I walked around the corner, and I caught up with the group as they were at the base of a block of units, pressing the buzzer, wanting to go up to their friend's place. And they were just laying into this kid. And they were going to take him inside. Who knows what would have happened to him? So what on earth do I do? Well, I'm one of those silly people who, you know, fight or flight, I go into fight mode too often. So without thinking about it, I just strode into the middle of this gang of young people and said, what do you think you're doing? You know, this kid, you're beating up on him. And then I realised, gee, because I could actually be in trouble here. we were hidden from everyone. We were behind bushes. No one could see us from the road. And there was this gang of 15 to 18-year-old kids. So I thought, I'm just going to keep on talking. So I just kept talking at them, grabbed this kid, pulled him out. He just ran for his life. I didn't see him again. And I was in a state of shock, so I got out of the circle and sort of went back and was existing in a state of shock. I had no idea what to do. I look back and think I should have called the police. I should have, you know, followed up on it. But I just had no idea what to do. And in many ways, for a long time, I felt like that with regards to domestic violence. And when I was at theological college, like I said to you earlier, I went to Moore College. I had a mate of mine who'd become a Christian after a very rough life. He'd been in many a barroom brawl, and he was walking through the back streets of Newtown to Redfern Station one day when he came across a couple involved in a domestic dispute. The man had his wife up against the wall, holding her by the throat, with his arm, fist up like this, raised like this, about to belt into her. And my mate, who'd been in many a blue, walked up face to face with this guy. The guy looked at him and said, "What the..." I won't use the exact language, it wasn't clean language. What do you want, mate?" I said, "I'm just waiting to see if you're going to hit your wife." "Yeah, what if are you going to do about it?" "If you do, I'm going to beat the crap out of you." And he would have. Sorry about the language, that was probably a milder version than we had. That's only how he knew how to respond to violence, with more violence. We often have no idea of how to deal with the violence that's in our midst. But what I've discovered as we've been going on this domestic violence campaign is we are in a very violent society. I just want to take you through some facts and statistics around domestic violence, about violence and domestic violence, and then reflect upon it in light of that passage we had read. Domestic violence is a serious and significant issue in our society. Since the age of 15, 1 in 2 men and 1 in 3 women will have experienced a violent encounter, at least one. Now, there's a very substantial difference between the way men and women experience violence. For men, it's nearly always outside the home. It's at the football, it's at the pub, it's on the streets, it tends to be isolated events. But for women, the place they are most likely to experience violence is in the home, either their own home or the home of somebody they know well. So if you look at that statistic there, 1 in 19 men have experienced physical or sexual violence from a current or former partner. 1 in 6 women have experienced physical or sexual violence from a current or former partner. That is an awful statistic, isn't it? There'll be people here in this church who've been in that situation, and as Dan encouraged you earlier, as we were talking about this, you need to do what you've got to do. You may need to take some time out. You might need to go talk to somebody. This might raise issues for you. I just want to encourage you to do what you've got to do to feel safe and deal with whatever is happening for you. But because the 1 in 6 women experience violence from a current or a former partner, it means that it tends not to be one-off. So you can see that 75% of those who've experienced violence have experienced more than one episode of violence. If you're a woman, you're likely to find that your experience of violence is repeated. 58% of women who've been a victim of violence have never reported it to police. And 25% have never told anyone. They're carrying around a deep scar, deep emotional wounds, and have not felt safe. 1 in 4 have not felt safe to tell somebody about it. Dan said we want to make our church a safe place. It's a great goal. It's horrible statistics, aren't they? Second thing I want to say about this is that domestic violence occurs in all types of households and across all segments of society. You find university professors who are suffering domestic violence and being beaten at home. You find CEOs who are experiencing domestic violence. It cuts across all social classes, all wealth, all degrees of wealth, all cultural backgrounds. There are, of course, some communities that have higher rates of domestic violence than others. So our Indigenous women, in particular, have very high rates of violence against them. But it's not something that happens to them out there. It's something that happens across every sector of society, And there is no doubt that there are people in this church and in the community that you work with who are experiencing violence. Think about the school you've got across here. 1 in 6 women will have experienced or are experiencing violence. It's a lot of people. Third statistic is this, or third reality about domestic violence is this. Domestic violence can be physical, sexual, financial, verbal, emotional, social, or spiritual. Behind the violence is this desire to control another person. People often think, you know, domestic violence, men hitting women, it's an anger control issue. It's actually not. Well, most of our counsellors are saying it's not. They say men who are violent in their homes don't have a problem outside their home controlling their anger. This is usually, not every situation is the same, but it's frequently issues around control and how do we relate to one another. I'll give you an example of this. My daughter, she's 23 years old, and last year she started a relationship with a young man from Sydney. He came up, he stayed at our home on a number of occasions. Lovely young guy. But what became very clear is that a pattern had emerged in their relationship where he wasn't physically violent, but he was extraordinarily emotionally abusive. He, in all kinds of ways, sought to control Ashley. So when he wasn't up with staying with us, he'd ring her 9, 10, 12 times a day. Where are you? Who are you with? He would get sullen if she said she was out with her friends. He'd get angry if she said she was out with her friends. He'd accuse her all the time of being unfaithful. All these insecurities manifested themselves in his need to control Ashley. It got to the point where he was up at our house a couple of times, and Sandy and I, as your parents, we sort of picking up what was going on before Ashley was. And we talked with Ashley about this, and I sat down and I had a heart to heart with this young man and said, look, your behaviour's abusive, his way's abusive, and it needs to end or you'll no longer be welcome in this house. And he said he'd change for about 2 weeks, and all was on again. Well, Ashley, by this point, had realised what was happening, and she broke the relationship off. And that led to another round of intense emotional abuse, where he was texting her repeatedly, telling her he was going to kill himself. And his mother got on the phone, begging to speak to Ashley. Please get back with my son. If you don't, I don't know what he'll do. And then came the point where Ashley received a text where he said, I'm in hospital and they've just revived me. If I tried to kill myself, I can't live without you. And Ashley was very concerned. She begged me to ring his mum and find out if he was okay. So I rang his mum. So we just wanted to check his son's okay. She said, oh, he's fine. He's sitting here with me on the lounge watching TV. Intense emotional abuse. I have no doubt that if the relationship had continued, it would have become physical as well. When we talk about domestic violence, we're talking about all those ways we abuse each other, abuse people in order to control their behaviour. And there's a whole bunch of patterns. You can read about them online. You can read about them at the No Place for Violence campaign website. But just be aware in your minds that we're not just talking those statistics I gave you about physical violence. We're actually talking about any ways that people try to control others in a fashion that's inappropriate. Fact number 4 is that domestic violence often follows a cyclical pattern. This is really important to understand. So I've tried to diagram that pattern here. So you can see right in the middle there, you get an explosion. It might be an explosion of physical violence. It might be an explosion of sexual violence. It might be you're not going out and you barricade the doors so your partner can't leave the home. It could be isolating, but you get this explosive reaction. Then what happens is typically what happened when I confronted that young man is remorse. I can't believe what I've done. And I'm sorry, I'll never do it again. In most cases, it's a short-term thing. The remorse leads to sort of a honeymoon period where very often I'm saying man and wife, the wife being the one who's the sufferer of violence. I understand that at times it's reversed, but usually it's not. So I'll speak in those terms. So that the woman says, oh, well, look, my husband's really making an effort. It's never been as good as this before. But usually the pattern then becomes that after a while, the old ways of seeking to control start to reassert themselves. The tension builds until there's another outburst of violence. And then the pattern repeats, remorse. Does that make sense? Now, what's really important for us is to realise that when is it that you are most likely to find out somebody's been the subject of abuse?
When you see the bruises.
Yeah, when you see the bruises after the explosion. And when you then meet up with the couple, this is why I think why pastors often find it difficult to handle this. He's so remorseful. He's so repentant. But what we need to understand is that in most cases that's part of an ongoing cycle. And so our response to domestic violence needs to take into account that this is a sick cycle in most cases, and the remorse will likely be short-lived. Don't treat it as a norm. And my fifth comment, which then before we go into the Bible, is that our churches often prioritise the voices and interests of men above women, and the institution of marriage above the well-being of the participants in the marriage. I remember when somebody first made that last statement to me years ago, I was shocked. We have such a high value of marriage, and we should. We should work as hard as we can to keep our marriages intact. But all too often what happens in situations of domestic violence in the past is women have been told, you have to submit to your husband. I know many women who were in situations of violence who were told, you've got to just live with your husband and be submissive to him and pray for him and encourage him to do the right thing. And at least one of those women ended up dead at the hands of the husband. I would suggest to you, we need to rethink whether we should protect the institution of marriage over against the interests of the people in the marriage. And that perhaps the husband who is violent has abandoned the marriage already, just hasn't left physically. The other thing we've done is we've classically favoured the voice of men over women. And so again, as I've been involved in this campaign, I've seen quite a number of women who've been sufferers of violence, survivors of violence, have said, you know, in the church, no one would believe me. Because my dad, he was on the diaconate. And when I raised the issue of the fact that he was beating my mother and beating us kids, we were told, don't be silly, you're just exaggerating. Because we know your dad, and he's such a great guy. Well, monsters don't exist. Real human people commit acts of violence. And we have this ability to be chameleon-like, so we can appear the most extraordinarily godly, gracious people in the church. You'd be at home committing acts of violence. One of the first times I ever came across a situation of domestic violence while I was pastoring was that a couple that were in the church, they were a similar age to Sandy and I, and the husband was one of the nicest blokes I thought I'd ever met. And his wife told me how he would have her up against the wall by the throat, spitting in her face, speaking words of violence, and the phone would ring, it might be the prayer chain. And he'd hold him with his hand against the wall. Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah, let's pray for it now. And they'd sit down and they'd pray on the phone, hang it up, and then he'd be back in the face. We've got to remember that this is a kind of a condition that people can hide for years and years, both the victims of violence and the perpetrators can hide. And our churches give them space when we don't prioritise the voices of women as much as we do men. All right, five facts around, or statements around violence. You might like to chat with me about some of those afterwards. What do we do about this biblically? What do we say? Well, there's a whole bunch of things we could pick up. I'd just like to pick up that theme we had read to us this morning, this idea that we are all created in the image and likeness of God. I don't know if you've ever realised how radical a statement that is in Genesis 1. It's an extraordinary statement, because in the ancient Near East, guess who were the only people normally described as bearing the image of the gods? Who do you think? The kings. The kings were seen as bearing the image of God, which meant they represented the gods on the earth, which meant they had the right to say all the rules, they had the right to have power, they had the right to dominate everybody. They were the ones who were the image bearers, and everybody else was their servants. And the Genesis text comes along and says, no, all of us bear the image and likeness of God. Every single one of us, man and woman, woman and man, we're all created in the image and likeness of God. And men and women aren't told to rule over each other. They were told to rule over the creation. It's a radical statement. Radically democratizes the idea of worth and value. And, you know, the way the Bible develops that concept, I think it says, if I am made in the image and likeness of God, what sort of person should I be striving to be? Well, the sort of person I should be striving to be, surely, is someone who reflects the character of God. And what's God's character? Love, kindness, compassion, generosity. Not self-interest, but astonishingly the service of creation. That's the God that comes to us in the Bible. That's the God who is revealed to us most fully in Jesus, is it not? So if me as a man, I say in my marriage, who do I want to be? I want to be that kind of person who's like Jesus. I want to disabuse myself of the notions of masculinity with which I've been raised. They tell me that being a man is about being in control. Control of my emotions, control of my life. I want to need people, as I shared before about what I've discovered with Parkinson's. I want to become vulnerable. I want to be a person who is opened up in love, grace and kindness and compassion. So the first thing I want to say, you know, if you find yourself in a situation where you are perpetrating abuse, it can be really hard to turn around from that. But I wonder if the first step is to say, who do I want to be? And then find help to become that person. There's some numbers on the little handout you've got you can use to ring and get help. But it also says to me something about how I treat my partner or my friends or people around me. Because if I bear the image of God, so do they. And that means they are worthy of my respect, my love, my care, my dignity. And I have no right to control. God doesn't seek to control us. God gives us freedom. Even freedom to choose what is bad. And so if we are to respect others as the image and likeness of God, we need to respect their freedom to make the choices over their lives that they seek to make. So this idea that we control one another, I think, really goes out the door on a Christian view of humanity. Yeah? All right, now we could say a whole lot more. There's so much in the Bible about power and control. But hopefully that's just a tidbit to get you thinking about it. So I really want to move to the final question, which is what do we do? What do we do? And there's this great phrase that what have I done there? I've repeated. Oh, hang on, I think I've gone back the wrong way. No? I don't know what I've done there. Doesn't matter. Three simple words. Recognize, respond, refer. Say them with me so you remember them. Recognize, respond, refer. So one more time, recognize, respond, refer. Okay, that's basically a threefold slogan that Baptist Care New South Wales picked up in their work. And it means this. First thing is be on the lookout. Now that we're aware how common and how prevalent violence is in our society, and particularly violence in our homes, we know that people are masters of hiding it. Well, be on the lookout for it. Look for the signs. If you find that you have a friend who says all to you all the time, my husband won't let me do that, my husband won't let me do that, my husband won't let me do that, you're probably seeing signs of some kind of abusive relationship. If you see a person who's covering up bruises, if you see a person who seems to be very uneasy when the topic comes up, not necessarily the case that they're experiencing abuse, but you get what I'm saying? Be aware and look out for the signs. Recognise when it occurs, if you can. The second thing is respond in a healthy way. What does that mean? Whatever you do, believe what you've been told. The person who's been suffering violence or perpetrating violence in secret for many years may have taken all their courage to let you know. The very worst thing you can do is to say, "Are you sure? I know Dave, I really don't think he'd be like that. You sure?" You'll be shocked. Absorb your shock. Because if you don't respond well, they may very well shut down and never tell another person. Believe what they're saying to you. Ask them to describe their experience and just listen. Let them tell you as much as they're prepared to, but leave as much unsaid as they need to leave unsaid. It's really just a space. Your response is a space just to say, "I'm here to listen. I believe you. My heart goes out to you. And I want to care for you." So unburden whatever you need to unburden. Ask them if they feel safe. "Do you feel safe going home today?" And if they say no, then get on the phone with them to one of those referral lines and find a way to help them find safety. They may say, "Yeah, I do feel safe, but I realise that I'm going to have to finish, I'm going to have to leave in the next few months." I'll know that statement as well. Find a way to support. I would say in that situation, get their permission. Maybe they've talked to Dan or one of the other leaders in the church, if it's in the church, to help you through that. Recognise, look out for the signs, respond with just listening and believing and empathising and seeing how you can help them feel safe. And the third thing is refer. This is dangerous business. You find that women's refuges, they might say the San Susie Women's Refuge, it won't be located anywhere near San Susie. We keep all the locations of refuges secret because men go searching for the women. When this comes out, you may be dealing with a very violent situation. You are not equipped to deal with it. Well, very few of us will be. So refer people on to those who can help them. Be their support, be their helper, but make sure you get the help of people with expertise. Again, encourage the person to ring the National Domestic Violence Hotline. If you're a pastor, you'll have a form, or a lot of community leaders have forms that they can sit down with a person and say, there's a series of questions, about 20 questions you go through to help figure out how much danger you're in at present, what do we need to do next? There are a whole bunch of resources out to help us. Not enough resources in Newcastle, where I live. We have a church down the road from us that actually has opened up its car park at night and its buildings at night to women fleeing domestic violence, because we have a massive shortage of refuge accommodation in Newcastle. So women either go back to their husbands or they're living in their cars with their children. And this church said, "This is outrageous." So they invite the women just to come. They can stay in the car park all night. They put security guards on to keep them protected. And then they open up the church facilities, the kitchen, the showers, the tables and chairs, so that women and the children who are living in their cars have a place to stay. It's awful that we have to do that. It's just astonishing to me that we don't have enough refuges in our society. But they've put in place a system that they've done it well. However you respond, you need to make sure you do it well. You do it in a way that is informed by the best learning on this issue, and in particular, takes into account the services that are out there. Does that make sense? Recognise the signs. Be open to people telling you. Respond in a way that is affirming of the individual when they tell you, not questioning them. And then refer them to people who can really help them, while at the same time you stay a person of care and support. It's a long road for us to deal with this issue, and the incidence of violence has actually been increasing in Australia in recent years, but hopefully as we come to grips with this, we can address the issue in our midst and see our places, our communities and our churches, as places of safety for all people. Thanks. Does anybody have a question they want to ask? Can we take a question or a comment?